from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. We are probably living in the most peaceful era in the history of our species, so says author Steven Pinker, and that may be hard to believe for regular viewers of the evening news, but the Harvard psychologist's research finds that when it comes to war, genocide, capital punishment, rape, hate crimes, and slavery, things are definitely looking up. Pinker joins us in studio to discuss his latest book, The Better Angels of Our Nature. And we ask you, our listeners, do you think global violence is on the decline? Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. Leading researcher and internationally recognized writer on language, mind, and human nature, Steven Pinker is Harvard University professor of psychology and the recipient of many awards, prizes, and honorary doctorates. He was named by Prospect Magazine as one of the world's top 100 public intellectuals and by Time Magazine as one of the 100 most influential people in the world today, as well as being selected as one of Foreign Policy's 100 Global Thinkers. He chairs the usage panel of the American Heritage Dictionary and writes for the New York Times, Time, and the New Republic, as well as having written books, which include The Language Instinct, How the Mind Works, and The Blank State. His most recent book is Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined, which presents the argument that we have become more peaceful as a species with a statistical trend downward in violence seen not only in the West but globally, in states and nations, as well as in families, tribes, neighborhoods, factions, and so forth. War, genocide, torture, rape, infanticide, and abuse of animals all, Steven Pinker argues, are trending downward. And he joins us in studio for this forum hour. Good to have you back.
Thank you.
Actually, the last time we were together was in Washington. You were by phone. I was doing Talk of the Nation. You were on yesterday, actually, much to your surprise, apparently. They decided to play an earlier program. This subject and your approach to it, your scholarly approach to it, is really quite extraordinary and fascinating, and we'll get listeners involved in what they think. Because the normal assumption for most people is, when it comes to violence, not quite as sanguine as you come out here and take the position. And yet you make the case, and you make the case with graphs and numbers, and you make the case with a historical argument, which is pretty convincing. Let's talk first about the idea, though, about the better angels of our nature, which comes from President Lincoln.
Yeah. That's right, yes. First
and inaugural you're talking address. About cognitive, you're talking about cultural, you're talking maybe even about genomics.
Yeah, I don't think that most of the changes that I document in the book are genetic in the Darwin sense of a change, evolution consisting of a change in gene frequencies over time, because some of them are just too recent. The decline of war between states is really a phenomenon that we've seen only since 1945, and that's way too quickly for it to have been caused by biological evolution in the technical sense. So this is clearly a cultural change, but it's one that engages parts of human nature that I argue can inhibit and counteract the uglier, nastier sides of human nature. Human nature is complicated. There's no answer to the question, are we basically peaceful or basically violent? We have parts of the brain that push us in both directions, and it depends on which one is more engaged by the environment we find ourselves in.
Well, even as far as war, there's a kind of division between war as deep roots adaptation or war as some kind of cultural, infection or meme.
Well, I think it's some of both. I think we have impulses that can result in war if we get lots of other people to go along with us. But one person can't wage a war. Remember that old bumper sticker from the 60s? What if they gave a war and nobody came? There is some truth in that. War requires organizing an army, getting a bunch of people to fight at the same time that you want to fight. And that clearly depends on social organization. On the other hand, the emotions that cause a leader to launch a war and easily recruit followers might come from parts of human nature, like a sense of honor, thirst for revenge, desire for dominance. And those I don't think have gone away, but they're less likely to result in organized war.
Well, as I said, you make the case, and you make it with an extraordinary amount of scholarship and just hard scholarly work showing how we've moved to see more democracy, see more trade, enlightenment, all of these kinds of things which suggest definite decline along with the numbers and so forth. And we get into, I know you spoke to the Long Now Foundation yesterday, we get into this idea of the long peace after World War II and after the millions who died in World War II. We've got wars going on in four continents now, though, and we've got not only wars going on in four continents, but we've got ongoing sense of aggression and warlike behavior and, well, frankly, hostilities that just don't seem to abate. One just has to look to Syria or Afghanistan, Iraq.
Yes, well, what those stories show is that the rate of violence has not fallen to zero. And yes, it has not fallen to zero. On the other hand, there were wars in five continents not so long ago, and they were longer and more brutal and killed far more people. There are fewer wars, and the wars that happen kill fewer people than they used to.
So this is evolutionary. This is a kind of humanistic sense of our evolving to a higher and more ennobling ideal?
I guess you could put it that way. I don't think it's certainly not evolution in Darwin's sense. And I don't think there's any mystical arc toward justice. I don't think there's any cosmic destiny toward greater peace. I think that violence really is a stupid solution to problems. It's very hard to lower violence because if you unilaterally renounce it, but your enemies don't, then you're a sitting duck. The challenge is, how do you get the other guy to renounce violence at the same time that you do? You're both better off if you both are nonviolent, but each one is better off if he's violent and you're not.
Are we seeing a renunciation of violence, though, or is this just simply a diminution of violence as you see it?
Both. You have aspirational statements like the founding charter of the United Nations, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So people get committed on paper to not using war to settle their disputes. But you also see it in the actual decision-making of states where more and more the idea of invading your neighbor just isn't on the table as a viable option. Whereas that used to be what states did. They were just in the business of conquest whenever they could get away with it. But now the world's borders are pretty close to frozen, and states just don't even consider the possibility of swallowing a neighbor or eating a chunk of their neighbor's territory.
Violence outside of states, though, we have all this rogue kind of violence. We have liberation movements, which, as you point out, began a sense of finding rights for different groups, which has certainly also diminished violence. But we also have rights groups that see themselves as, well, the necessity of fomenting violence as part of their credo.
That's true. And there was, although there was a decline in wars between countries starting in 1945, there was in the 60s and 70s an increase in the number of wars within countries, civil wars, although they too did a U-turn after the fall of the Soviet Empire around 1990. And civil wars, on average, do much less damage than interstate wars. Certainly, they can cause a lot of misery and suffering for the people concerned. But the thing is, there are far fewer people concerned than there are when you have two nations that are bombing each other's cities and chucking artillery shells at each other and lining up thousands of tanks to face each other.
And certainly what's happened in Syria or what happened in Iran with the Green Revolution, though, so that is set aside, or how do we?
Oh no, well, no, you got to count those. You can't set anything aside, but still, you add them all up, and the number of deaths is far less than it was in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Remember, the Assad's father carried out a massacre in Syria that killed 20,000 people in the 1980s. We've kind of forgotten about it because news coverage wasn't as complete at the time. That's one of the reasons people think violence has increased. We're better and better at covering it, and we care more about it. More and more of the world we feel is part of our circle of concern. So we know more about violence. We care more about violence. Both of those are very good things, but it leads to the misperception that violence has increased.
That misperception, you point out, has a lot to do with the media. If it bleeds, it leads, and you know what is in the news, as well as perhaps a decline in glorification of violence, which a lot of people would say Hollywood, decline in glorification of violence. But it's certainly true that most of our media does put too much emphasis on violence. And yet, actually, your work has been criticized for, in fact, somebody called you staggeringly naive about how the media decides on what violence to show us and doesn't show us, for example, this is actually this would be devil's advocate time maybe, but this is actually an article that took the position that there's been so much violence done by the United States that has been left out of the media and continues to be done in subversion and torture renditions going back to the Bush administration, that sort of thing.
There is violence done by the United States. The United States launched two wars in the first decade of the 21st century. But the figures that I cite in the book are from international organizations that are certainly no friends of the United States. And and even with the violence of the Iraq and Afghan wars, the curves are unmistakably downward. And the United States used to commit greater violence in Vietnam, for example. There were perhaps 2 million Vietnamese killed. In Iraq, it's maybe 150,000. That's 150,000 too many. And most of those were not, of course, killed by American soldiers, but by other Iraqis. But still, there's a big difference between 2 million and 150,000.
Our guest is Steven Pinker. His new book is The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. I wonder what you say to, a couple of authors, Edward Herman and David Peterson, who did a piece in ZNet. And they call you, this is kind of name-calling, an apologist for Western imperial violence. And they point out that the CIA continues to do cross-border seizures of people and take property and, U.S. sanctions, bombings, subversions, all the invasions, all these kinds of things don't seem to count in your book.
They do count. I don't know what they're talking about. This is an attack, by the way, from the extreme left wing. These are ideologues. So I don't really take that kind of attack seriously. It's not based on the kind of evidence that I think has to be brought to bear in deciding whether violence has gone up or gone down. And the fact that the United States does commit violence now says nothing about whether it commits more now than it did in the past. It's just a mathematical error to say, well, I see some violence happening today, therefore it's increased. That's not what a trend means. A trend means that you compare a rate at time one and time two, and you show that there's more at time one than time two. Just saying that violence has not gone down to zero doesn't tell us anything about whether it's increased or decreased. It's just a mathematically illiterate argument.
There's also a lot in your book about gender related, that violence is largely, as far as a pastime, male.
By and large, violence is a guy thing, at least certain kinds of violence. In every society, in every category of violence, men do more of it than women. This isn't to say that women never commit acts of violence, but they're, in the book, I distinguish different motives for violence. I don't think there's one thing called an aggressive instinct. I think we have different motives, and there's some of them that are far more gendered than others. In particular, the quest for dominance, to be top dog, alpha male, the sport that I euphemistically call competitive distance urination. All of those are male concerns. I think women can use violence as a means to an end, just purely practical or instrumental violence. It's not that women never commit violence, but stupid violence just to prove who is superior is far more a male pastime.
There used to be the argument that women heads of state somehow were always linked to aggressive actions or war or militant actions, Thatcher, Bhutto, Golda Meir, Indira Gandhi.
Well, I think women as heads of state is an example of how violence sometimes has to be used in an instrumental sense, that is just to get certain things done. And there's no reason to think that you'd expect a gender difference as part of an international system. No matter how pacifist you might be, if you find yourself responsible for a state in a world of other hostile states, it would be suicidal to be the only pacifist. And that's why you do have women leaders sometimes leading their countries in war when the situation demands it. But you don't tend not to have the kinds of insane wars of conquest that a Napoleon or a Hitler launched. And you have
few... Just because of subsiding in nationalism in part?
I think it is. So I think that is, there is, you could even call it a feminization of world values, that the defense of honor, the resolve to retaliate with violence against any insult, typically masculine vices tend to be in decline, and indeed women have become more empowered at the same time. I think the two developments are probably related.
But there's also the rights revolution that you continue to come back to, and that's a more humanizing thing. I mean, seeing gays as human beings, gays and lesbians as human beings, seeing women more as liberated or human beings demanding social equality and getting it in many instances in certain parts of the world, of course.
That's right. Well, although it is a global trend, it's far more, like many declines of violence, it originated in certain parts of the West, but is spreading to the rest of the world. So in the West, you have a decrease in rates of domestic violence and rape, a change in laws to favor victims of violence. For example, it used to be that men could rape their wives at will, that marital rape was not even a concept. That is no longer true.
True in some. I mean, in Brazil, for example, if a man rapes his wife, it's almost certain that he'll get off. And this is very much a developing nation.
Yes, well,
that
used to be true.
A whole piece on this, in fact. Yeah.
That used to be true in the United States as well, that there was no concept of marital rape. A man had the right to sex with his wife. That's changed in every Western country, and that is a global trend. Fewer and fewer countries have laws on their books that exclude husbands from potential rapists. We don't have statistics for trends in domestic violence in other countries. We know that it occurs, but once again, the fact that it occurs doesn't mean it's gone up. You can only tell if it's gone up or not if you have estimates at two different points in time. So saying, look, there's domestic violence in the developing world doesn't say that worldwide it has increased. It just says that it has not gone down to zero. And by far, the trend is toward reducing it. It's the United Nations resolutions that most countries have signed on to protect the rights of women. There are international shaming campaigns, which in the past have been effective at reducing other categories of violent behavior, like slavery, like whaling, like atmospheric nuclear testing. So there, too, the momentum is absolutely in the direction of reducing violence against women.
One could argue also that perhaps, in fact, I think Stuart Brand from The Long Now used to argue that maybe the reason that nuclear weapons haven't been used was because they were used so fatally in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that kind of vaporization, to use a word I think that you favor, is something that has perhaps created a kind of mutual destruction that hasn't occurred.
Well, there is the argument that I consider in the book that the long piece is a nuclear piece. The one scholar even suggested that the nuclear bomb be given the Nobel Peace Prize. I'm actually skeptical of that argument. While nuclear weapons might deter an existential threat, an absolute invasion that annihilates a country, other than that, it hasn't had a huge effect on the actual conduct of wars because it's so disproportionately destructive compared to any rational war aim that it's almost off the table as a viable option. Argentina, for example, invaded the Falkland Islands held by Britain, knowing that Britain was a nuclear power, and of course Argentina was not. But they were confident that London was not going to leave Buenos Aires a radioactive crater. So they thumbed their nose at the British and they invaded the Falklands anyway.
Mrs. Thatcher was chief of state then, in fact.
Pardon me?
I say Mrs. Thatcher was the chief of state.
That's right. And she did not use the nuclear option. So it's become because there's almost a taboo against considering the use of nuclear weapons in real wars, it doesn't really figure in the conduct of most wars, other than deterring an absolute existential invasion.
Our guest again is Steven Pinker, Harvard professor of psychology, author of a new book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. And we put out the question to you, do you believe violence has declined? And you may indeed want to join this conversation, not only with respect to that question, but put in your own opinion or ask questions, given the sense of really the importance of this discussion and the conversation that really holds some great matters attached to it, to put it mildly. Our toll-free number is available, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. You can join us at that 866-733-6786. Again, feel free to call us now at 866-733-6786. You can also email us. Our email address is forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you have on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and click on the segment, or, of course, go to our Facebook page or tweet us, and our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And Steven Pinker will be at the JCC in Palo Alto this evening as part of the Silicon Valley Commonwealth Club series. He'll be there at 7 o'clock p.m. And you mentioned many of the great philosophers, and including Thomas Hobbes, who always favored the line from Leviathan that life is a span from womb to tomb. But if it's not all about power and glory that we're seeking now, or that's all diminished and therefore has diminished violence, what about Hobbes's arguments about scarcity and uncertainty, and that those can be certainly catalysts to violence, especially when we're facing all of these resource and climate change crises?
Well, uncertainty is something that can be enhanced or reduced collectively. That is, and Hobbes pointed this out, one of the reasons that I'm uncertain about whether my neighbor will invade me is my neighbor is uncertain about whether I'll invade him. And if you have the spreading notion that war is ridiculous, stupid, wasteful, cruel, harmful, archaic, then you can calm everyone down and you can have zones of peace where just no one stays up worrying about whether their neighbor is going to invade them. France and Germany, for example, a very unusual break with history, but neither one's particularly worried that the other will invade them. And that that can have a reverberating effect, as Hobbes pointed out, because fear can generate fear, which can cause violence even among the nonviolent. As for resources, it's actually surprising how few wars in recent history have been fought over resources. Now, there is, of course, a far-left conspiracy theory that all wars are fought over resources, that Vietnam was really a war about tungsten and the Falklands, it was really about the minerals of Argentina. But if you sweep aside the conspiracy theories and actually look more closely at the facts, most wars are fought over fear, as Hobbes pointed out, honor, revenge, ideology, righting historical wrongs. Countries actually don't go to war a whole lot over minerals or water. Now, it could happen in the future, but the studies that try to correlate resource shortages at time one with war at time two find little to no correlation.
Now, you're sort of a Darwinist. I mean, not sort of. You are a Darwinist, aren't you?
In the sense that I believe that there exists human nature and that it's best explained by the causal forces that shaped human nature, namely Darwin's mechanism of natural selection. Yeah.
And Darwin did view human behavior in terms of, he said, we're animals. And, you know, there's little denial of that. I wonder, I couldn't help thinking as I was reading your book about Flannery O'Connor popped into my consciousness because there's a story of hers, a well-known story called A Good Man is Hard to Find, where this misfit, the serial killer, says, my daddy said I was a different breed of dog. And there is that feeling that certain human beings are almost like different breeds of dogs. You know, there are some that are quite more predisposed to a gentle nature and temperament and whatever, and some are just basically innately much more aggressive and hostile and filled with enmity. Don't you agree?
Yes. I mean, I don't think there are two kinds. I think there's probably a continuum. But there's.
I didn't mean to suggest there were only two. Yeah.
No, that's right.
There is a whole continuum.
But absolutely, yes. I mean, I think at the tail of the distribution, there are people who probably for genetic reasons have much more of a thirst for violence than others.
But you see those people as being somewhat more bridled by the fact that impulsive behavior and is being supplanted by reason or being at least to some extent diminished by reason, that sort of, and violence is of course being overtaken by reason?
I think on the whole it is. So for example, you're more likely to see violence confined to the psychopathic fringe as opposed to being a normal response, say, of a man of honor to challenge a rival to a duel or pull out a sword if he's been insulted. So the respectable people in the middle of the distribution are less likely to use violence. More and more violence will be confined to people who are more predisposed to it. But even they respond to incentives, and if you have more effective law enforcement and less anarchy, they're less likely to have free rein to cause damage and destruction. It's in zones of anarchy that the psychopaths can create havoc, and then everyone else has to be violent to protect themselves from the psychopaths.
When we return, we'll hear from you, our listeners. Again, Steven Pinker, our guest, author of The Blank Slate and The Stuff of Thought, the new book, The Better Angels of Our Nature. And again, he'll be Silicon Valley Commonwealth Club this evening, Palo Alto JCC at 7 o'clock p.m. You can post your questions or comments on our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or go to our Facebook page or call us at 866-733-6786. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We are probably living in the most peaceful era in the history of our species, so says author Steven Pinker. That may be hard to believe for regular viewers of the evening news, but the Harvard psychologist's research finds that when it comes to war, genocide, capital punishment, rape, hate crimes, and slavery, and for that matter, abuse to animals. Things are definitely looking up. He's with us in studio talking about his most recent book, The Better Angels of Our Nature. And we're asking you, our listeners, do you think global violence is on the decline? And you can weigh in here by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and clicking on this segment, or going to our Facebook page or tweeting us. And our Twitter handle is at kqedforum. In fact, let me look at some of the responses from some of you on the Facebook page. Here are a few responses to the question of whether global violence is on the decline. Joe writes, people might be, but not the governments. Stephen says, Americans love the idea of apocalypse and refuse to give it up. I predict you will get mostly negative calls to this show. Mike asks, define less violent. Are you talking about macroscopic manifestations like wars or attitude changes like spanking children or gladiator sports like NFL and ultimate fighting? I'm getting a kind of a different picture here, but this is a lot of these responses are along the lines of you found in terms of readers of your book, haven't they?
Yeah, well, the answer to the question of how I define violence is the use or threat of physical force. So, yes, it includes gladiatorial combat, includes capital punishment, it includes war, homicide, rape, kidnapping, assault, all of the forms of physical violence. I don't include cases of where the victim chooses to endure violence. So I don't include voluntary sports. I don't include, you know, rough sex if it's between consenting adults. Cases where there really is a victim in the sense that the victim doesn't want to be spanked or slapped around. So in terms of the American government, again, this is a kind of hard left core belief that the United States is the most odious entity in the world today, and that all of the world's problems come from the malevolence of the United States. Now, I'm under no illusions about the beneficence of the United States. The United States has done a lot of bad things, but they are all in the statistics, and the United States is by far not the only perpetrator of violence today, and it commits far less violence than it used to.
You know where else the ideologues come down on you, though? I mean, you use all the philosophers of the Enlightenment and talk about reason becoming much more ascendant. But they say, where are those great philosophers of the Enlightenment like Bakunin or Lenin or those who have advocated violence as part of their whole ethos?
Well, I don't think anyone would identify Lenin as an Enlightenment philosopher. And Bakunin was an anarchist. He was not a violent anarchist.
But the ideologues say they are Enlightenment philosophers. That's my point. I think
Lenin?
Lenin.
One of the
Lenin,
world's...
Bakunin, Engels, Marx, they all see those thinkers as coming out of the Enlightenment.
Yes. Lenin, of course, was one of history's great mass murderers, so it's a little ironic to associate him with the Enlightenment. But when I talk about the Enlightenment, I don't talk about every thinker that has come into prominence since the late 18th century. I refer in particular to Enlightenment humanism, the doctrine that reason is the way to arrive at the best social, moral, and political arrangement, and moreover, that the good to be maximized is human flourishing, and that human suffering is to be minimized. Now, that might sound like, you know, kind of pabulum, like who could disagree with that? And the answer is almost everyone has disagreed with that until very recently.
Because, well, especially despots and
exactly. Well, it's despots and religious and political utopians and ideologues who hold out the glory of the race, the religion, the nation, the class struggle as the moral imperative. And what happens to the individual men, women, and children is kind of, you know, a minor detail in these great belief systems. The idea that it's the men, women, and children who count, that's the idea that I see as coming out of the Enlightenment, and that's what I call Enlightenment humanism.
And the animals. I mean,
and
Peter
animals,
Singer,
yes,
gave
sentient,
you
absolutely sentient,
strong props for your book and for your position, and, you know, who could be more identified with animal welfare? I'm going to go to our callers here, but I have to ask you, how do you determine the intelligence quotient of someone like Martin Van Buren or James Buchanan?
Oh, yes. Well, this is Dean Simonton is a psychologist at University of California, Davis, who has made a career out of doing what he calls historiometry, that is collecting evidence from historians' and biographers' impressions combined with biographical details to get an estimate of the intelligence of historical figures.
And IQ is pretty much still a verbal test largely, isn't it, predominantly?
No. Most IQ tests have spatial and arithmetic components to them. Some of them are purely spatial.
But largely verbal, I think.
No. The Wechsler test, for example, has two subscores, a verbal and a nonverbal.
Let's go to our callers and hear what they have to say verbally. Karen, hi, you're on the air.
Thank you. I have to weigh in completely on the other side, and I'm sure that the response will be long and against what I have to say. But has Mr. Pinker watched Half the Sky by film that just was aired on KQED-TV by Nicholas Kristof? Has he read Eating Animals by Jonathan Safran Foer? Does he really think that literally billions of animals live lives of utter torture through factory farming, that millions and millions of women and children are sold into sexual slavery, are cut and given female circumcision in Africa? I wish that his thesis were true. And frankly, yes, he's from Harvard, and I'm just an intelligent citizen, but I truly believe that it's a bunch of hogwash, and I am literally shaking from being offended that he can think that when 40% of our cocoa beans are harvested by child slaves on the Ivory Coast, what is he talking about? I am just baffled.
Stephen,
it's easy because the argument is not that violence today is zero. The argument is that violence is less than what it used to be. And just saying that violence continues to exist says nothing about whether it's increased or decreased. To show that those facts that the caller mentioned represent an increase, you'd have to say that there was less of that in the past. How do you know there was less of it in the past? There was much more slavery in the past. There was much more exploitation of children in the past. So all it says is that violence hasn't gone down to zero.
Let me thank the caller. Actually, Johan writes this following email. The numbers make it very clear that violence has declined over the long haul, and then asks this question, which I think is a very important one. Are there any ways you think this trend could be accelerated in the near future?
Yeah, I think there are. I think having decent government spread to more and more of the world, that is, have try to eliminate zones of anarchy or of inept governance, have governments that can keep law and order without brutalizing their citizens, provide enough services like education and health care that people have a reason to support the government rather than the guerrillas. So that's one direction.
How do you view the Arab Spring? Because the Arab Spring was supposed to be, according to the neocons and many who were behind it, a way to democratize this region of the world. And certainly one could argue that that happened to a degree in Egypt. It happened to a bigger degree in Tunisia. But the fact of the matter is that we have this horrible violence in Libya, and now we have this ongoing horrible violence in Syria.
Yes, well, it is a mixed picture, and it's too soon to tell how it will come out. But it is part of a worldwide trend toward a greater number of democracies. So the Arab Spring occurred after the book was complete, but I have a graph in the book showing the number of democracies and autocracies, and it continues that trend. The violence in Syria is certainly horrific, but it is nothing compared to past episodes of violence in the Arab world, like the Iran-Iraq war, which killed hundreds of thousands. It is what it is. There is definitely an outburst of violence, but worldwide, the amount of violence is far less than what it was in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, to say nothing of the world wars and past centuries. So remember that you never see a reporter standing on a street corner saying, here I am in Uruguay or in Botswana, and it's been several decades and there hasn't been a war and nothing is blowing up behind me. We don't call that news.
Well, in fact, Jim writes, I think the evolution that Michael refers to is the ever-increasing ubiquity of pervasive and instantaneous communication media that serve to keep the wrongdoers from wrongdoing because the perils they face of getting caught and punished at street level. It's cell phone cameras that capture acts of thugs and allow for instant reporting to the police. At the global level, it's Twitter, Facebook, the internet in general, allowing for bright sunlight to be applied to the wrongdoings of state leaders.
I think it's beautifully put, and I think it's quite insightful. The world has 5 billion cell phones. Many of them now are internet-enabled and video-enabled, so anyone can become a reporter. So the violence in Libya and Syria gets reported to us in real time, but we forget about earlier massacres like the one committed by Hafez Assad in the town of Hama that killed more people than have been killed in the Syrian civil war so far. But that, we forget about it, occurred at in a place and a time that reporters couldn't get to. But we know that the death toll was high, and that's what we tend to forget in concentrating on the news this evening.
The son is catching up with his father's numbers, though, I'm afraid.
he might catch up. Well, that's just one episode from Hafez Assad. He killed a lot more people than that.
Mark, you're our next caller. Join us, Mark. You're on.
Thank you. It appears that there are two concepts here. One is the empirical data, which is that violence is down. And then the second is more of a thesis, which is, well, what's the causation of that? My question then is, have you considered the shift burgeoning, let me check that, the geometric increase in population on the planet since you went back to World War II as a watershed moment or a change in global wars, as a basis for cause? Let me give you just an example. Is there a notion that there's just too many people to be this violent with each other? Or on the empirical data side, when you talk about the numbers coming down, are they raw numbers or are they as a percentage of population? And that's my question. Have you considered the increase in population?
Well, it depends on the category, but when it comes to say homicides, it doesn't make sense really to count the total number of victims, because as the population increases, so does the number of potential murderers and the number of potential murder victims. So it would say nothing if a country of 300 million people had more homicides than a country of 10 million people, as would be the case of the United States a couple of centuries ago. So that is certainly per capita. For the decline of war since 1946, the decline is evident whether you count bodies or you do it per capita. It's obviously more dramatic when you do it per capita because the population of the world has exploded, but it's a decline in either case. If you have, in particular, if there's no war and no casualties, it doesn't matter how you count it. Now, it's interesting to raise the possibility that with an increase in population, you would expect a decrease in violence. I often get the opposite objection. As you crowd people together, aren't they going to get on each other's nerves more and compete over scarce resources?
That was once almost a sociological shibboleth.
Absolutely. And it turns out to be completely wrong that some of the world's most crowded places are among the world's most peaceful places, like Hong Kong and Tokyo.
Or who would have predicted what happened in New York City, in fact?
Exactly. New York City had a more than halving of the violent crime rate since 1992 as its population continued to go up. And of course, the world now has 7 billion people. In the 1960s, it had 3 billion people. But there's far less war now than there was in the 1960s. Now, whether the causation goes in the opposite direction, the one that you suggested, when we have more people, is war just so much more costly? It may not be that it works that way, but it is possible that as we have a global village, the people who are on the earth are more connected, know more about each other's lives, can see what daily life is like in other parts of the world. That might make it harder to demonize people you don't know, and it could have contributed to the globalization of human rights.
When you mentioned global village, it prompts me to ask you, did you take a course from McLuhan when you were at McGill?
I didn't know. He was at University of Toronto.
Oh, I thought he was at McGill.
Yeah, so he's a fellow Canadian, but wrong university.
More of your calls. We go to Andrew next. Andrew, join us.
Yeah, hi. My name is Andrew. I'm a little bit interested in how you reconcile the quality of data differences between now and in the past. So I think you may have covered this, but as media covers violence more and more, how do you reconcile that with your prior data from the past when we didn't cover violence quite as much to come to your conclusions?
Yeah, it's an excellent point, and it means that the data, in fact, are biased against the hypothesis that I'm suggesting, because a lot of violence in the past was a tree falling in the forest with no one to hear it, especially in the more remote parts of the world that were not as well connected. So I rely on the work of other scholars who do their best to try to estimate the death tolls from past wars and atrocities. Obviously, these have to be approximate. Many of them are orders of magnitude. But you know, for example, that there can't have been more people killed than there is a population of the country. Many countries, such as China, had extremely accurate census records, and so you could see what the census was before and after a war. There are also ways of bracketing the lowest plausible estimate and the highest plausible estimate. You take the geometric mean between them. It's unlikely to be too far off. You plot things in logarithms instead of in actual quantities, so errors of estimation don't push the numbers around as much. Those are some of the stratagems that you do to try to make up for the admittedly crummy quality of statistics from past eras.
And what about present statistics? I mean, what do we make, for example, or how do we figure into this whole calculus drone warfare, which is burgeoning, or for that matter, suicide bombing, which is burgeoning as well?
Oh, those aren't. I mean, they're not that hard to count, and they're maybe burgeoning, but they kill a tiny fraction of the number of people killed.
We don't know how many
wars
are being killed by drones. I think that's a pretty generally recognized fact. I mean, it may be still small, but we don't have the real figures.
Yeah, but what we see, for example, from the WikiLeaks figures as of 2010 in Afghanistan, there are people being killed by drones. Everyone knows that, but it's just a completely different order of magnitude compared to bombing cities into rubble, which was the way that wars were practiced in earlier decades.
What about military expenses? When you have a candidate like Governor Romney saying we need to spend more on the military, we need to increase expenses, even though there are those, Robert Gates, for example, Secretary of Defense, who says we need to keep it where it is, we don't need to spend more. This is a kind of militarization that suggests more violence, doesn't it? Or more defense, I'm not sure.
Well, military expenditures are largely political rather than responses to actual threats. And I think there is a plausible argument that our military is way too big compared to the reasonable threats that we face. To have military bases in 40 countries, hundreds of them, defending against threats like a Russian invasion of Western Europe that is almost certainly not going to happen, represents colossal waste. So the American military establishment is completely disproportionate to the level of objective threat.
And you would say the same about NATO, which has continued to grow and grow almost exponentially in some ways.
Well, as a percentage of GDP, defense expenditures have plummeted since the Cold War. The United States has done its best to buck that trend, but the rest of the world, defense expenditures are way, way down. And even in the United States, it plunged after the end of the Cold War. The Bush administration, of course, jacked it back up. But even now, it is less than what it was during the peak of the Cold War. I think a better index of preparedness for war than military expenditures, which is completely political. I mean, it's relevant that you mentioned that Romney brought it up. You can't have any candidate saying, I want to cut the military because then he's branded as soft on defense and weak and all that stuff.
Don't you remember President Nixon's peace dividend?
Right. Well, there was a peace dividend in the 90s. But I think a better index of war readiness is what percentage of the population is in uniform, how many countries have a draft, how long the draft is. And there, the draft has been eliminated in more and more countries, including, of course, the United States. Percentage of the population in uniform has been in a free fall all over the world, with the exception of a couple of countries, North Korea, for example.
Stephen Pinker is our guest. Speaking about North Korea, do you think, as you know, I'm in the process of writing a book on honor, and there is a kind of nuclear honor, or wanting to be a part of the nuclear club, whether it's North Vietnam or and Pakistan, or excuse me, North Korea and Pakistan, or for that matter, Iran. And it suggests greater militarization to me. It suggests, wanting to have weaponry, even though, of course, Iran's official statements are quite the contrary. They're just using developing nuclear energy for peaceful means. But they want to be, they have the honor of being in this nuclear club, I think.
Yes, that's right. And if North Korea was a typical country, then you would say, yes, the world has gotten more warlike.
There's nothing typical about North Korea.
But there's nothing typical. That's my point. Yeah. And of course, before, it's not just North Korea. I mean, why does France have a nuclear arsenal? It's really maintain the glory of the concept of France as a great power.
The common wisdom is if Iran develops nuclear weapons, that will lead to Saudi Arabia wanting nuclear weapons and so forth.
Probably not. It was said that when North Korea developed nuclear weapons, then it would be inevitable that Japan and South Korea and Taiwan would all want them, and they've been uninterested. So the talk of nuclear proliferation has always predicted runaway arms races in regions. That there were predictions there'd be 30 to 35 nuclear powers by now, but that isn't what has happened.
We'll bring more of your calls on. Again, we're talking to Steven Pinker. His new book is The Better Angels of Our Nature, and our next caller is Herb. You're on.
Yes, I'd like to know if you'd elaborate a little bit more on how the environment influences which or what of our better natures becomes manifest, and what effect that fear might have on the sense of our freedom or feeling free.
Yeah, well, the environment is changes in the environment, and I assume by environment you mean the social and political and economic environment, not just trees and rivers and mountains. All the changes that I document in the book, I attribute to changes in the social and political environment, such as the presence of a judicial system and police force and halfway decent government, the opportunities to for trade and commerce so that you can buy things more cheaply than you can steal them, the rise of literacy and the decrease of ignorance and superstition, the availability of media that make it possible to empathize with a larger and larger percentage of the world's population. Those are all environmental changes that reduce the temptation toward violence. Fear, as you mentioned, though, is a potent motivator toward violence, and this was one of Hobbes's points. It was fear of a new age of catastrophic terrorism that led to the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq. And managing fear is indeed one of the ways in which we control the temptations toward violence.
I thank the caller. And William from Orinda writes, isn't it almost a requirement of human nature that the enemy needs to be depersonalized before a population can be motivated to attack them? If so, doesn't the shrinking of the world from our increasing capacity to communicate and travel point in a very hopeful direction? You're saying essentially yes.
Yes, I think it's a profound point that it's not a guarantee that you will respect and empathize someone if you rub shoulders with them, if you have insight into their lives, if you hear.
You might dislike
them
more, actually.
you might dislike them more, exactly. But I think that is the way the trend goes. And there are experiments by social psychologists that show that if you do rub shoulders with or hear the words of a person in some stigmatized category, then you're more sympathetic to that person and to the category that the person represents. So in the lab, there is some evidence for this phenomenon.
It's the humanization, really, and the move away from objectifying other human beings.
Exactly right, yeah.
Here's Darren, who says the only people experiencing less violence on this planet are white people.
No, that's completely false. For one thing, the decline in rates of war is a global phenomenon. You add up all the deaths from all the wars combined, and they are down in Africa. They are down certainly in East Asia. But Africa has far fewer wars than it used to and far fewer people killed in war. And in the Western countries, the practice of lynching, for example, which used to kill 150 African Americans a year, went down to zero by the 1950s. Hate crimes are down since they were first measured, in both homicide and assault and intimidation. No, this is a worldwide phenomenon that by no means affects only white people. In fact, it's given the number of people in Asia, they are probably the biggest beneficiaries of all. You don't have wars like the Chinese Civil War, the Vietnam War, that would kill people by the millions.
And yet when one thinks of genocides, one thinks of post-World War, and one thinks of people of color, Cambodia, Rwanda, so forth.
But there are also, earlier in the century, of course, there was the Holocaust, there was the Armenian genocide. There were Stalin's purges. There was the genocide of the ethnic Germans in the years following World War II. It's true that the decline of interstate war and of genocide started in Europe and the West following World War II, but it is a trend that has spread to the rest of the world.
Bosnia, of course. Here's Michelle, who writes, given that so much of our most popular entertainment is graphically violent, from video games to movies and television to graphic images on the news and media, have you encountered any research that suggests this exposure is making people more violent, or does it have no effect?
My best guess is it has no effect. There's no evidence that it makes people more violent. in the heyday of violent video games, which is now and has skyrocketed since the 90s, corresponds with the great American crime decline, the falling of the rate of homicide and every other category of violent crime by more than half since the early 1990s.
Of course, the population is getting older, but maybe it's sublimation too on some level. Is that plausible?
I don't think it's sublimation either. So that would predict the exact opposite effect. Yeah. You get people, they get their violent impulses out through video games. They're less likely to do it in real life. So in analyzing the psychology and neurobiology of violence, I don't see any evidence that violence is some kind of hydraulic pressure that has to get out or that builds up and needs release. So it's not like hunger, thirst, sex, the need to sleep. The longer you do without, the more you want it. If you get it out through one outlet, you don't have to get it out through another outlet.
Isn't that a common view of violence?
It is.
People build up stress and they build up anger and it's an accretion that just has to be released.
Yeah, and I don't think that's the way violence works. I think violence is much more driven by environmental threats and stimuli. If you're making a biological analogy, it might be closer to shivering than to, say, thirst, where if you get cold, you shiver. If you live the rest of your life in a warm environment, you may never shiver again, even though you always have that capacity. I think people do have a taste for violent entertainment. That is a great constant of history. It's not just video games, but it's Shakespearean tragedies and histories.
It's the Colosseum.
The Colosseum. It's the Old Testament. It's the lives of the saints. It's Punch and Judy. It's the Grimm's fairy tales. So people have always enjoyed vicarious and simulated violence. But other than giving young men something to do other than hanging out in the street getting into trouble, where I think it might reduce violence by that simple mechanism, I don't think there's a close relationship.
You don't think there's maybe some didactic element too? You know, this is how I can do it or how I should defend myself or assault somebody if I need to do it, whatever?
So if you decide to kill someone, you might be more effective because of the practice you get from video games?
Well, not only that, but I think, you know, some of the there's a not-so-subliminal message in a lot of violent entertainment that says if you're dissed, if you're mistreated, whatever, you have to respond violently.
If you see Romeo and Juliet, are you going to go out and start a sword fight with another aristocratic family?
Well, it depends.
In the streets?
If you're in love with somebody and your families don't get along, maybe, but that's a different story.
I think it's extremely unlikely in today's environment.
Wish we could continue this conversation. Yeah. It's fascinating. Always great to have you on. Thank you so much for being here. Steven Pinker's The Better Angels of Our Nature. Appreciate your being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Steven Pinker, again, will be appearing at the JCC in Palo Alto this evening at 7 o'clock as part of the Silicon Valley Commonwealth Club. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our producers are Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Amanda Stupai. Our engineer today is Howard Gelman, and Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Another hour ahead for all of us here at KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.